quite ambiguous, even contradictory, on the deeper questions concerning the status of European domination, or the quasi-ontological status of European domination of non-Europeans. Liberal anti-colonialists, in other words, take the humane position that colonies and slaves ought not to be ruled or held, but in the case, for example, of the Enlightenment philosophers, don't dispute the fundamental superiority of Western man, or in some cases, that the white race is constitutively superior to all others. This view, I believe, tended to insinuate itself right at the heart of those 19th century disciplines and discourses dependent on knowledge observed and collected within the colonial settings, the subject of many books. Most naturalists and explorers, for instance, experienced a consolidation of their capacities as whites to do the observing and exploring that these species being observed and collected did not possess. There was a reinforcement in such studies as such fields as linguistics and historiography of the essentially imperialist view that non-European, non-whites were subordinates in most of the ways that counted. Along with this view was the appearance in the middle of the 19th century, was the appearance in the West of missions from places like, say, Japan and Egypt, missions that had been sent to try to learn the ways of the advanced white man, translate his work, pick up his habits. Recent studies on the subject by Masao Miyoshi, his book As We Saw Them, and Ibrahim Abdulluhid's book The Arab Rediscovery of Europe, stress the extent to which the imperial hierarchy was imparted to eager students from the East, along with the information, useful texts, and profitable habits that they quite successfully acquired. And out of that particular dynamic of dependency came the first long, reactive experience of native, or nativist rather, anti-imperialism, typified in the exchange in the 60s and 70s between El Afghani and Ernest Renan, in which, using terms defined and advanced by Renan, the native Afghani, attempts to disprove the imperialist assumptions about his inferiority. The discussion had been whether Islam was a system that inhibited science or not. And poor old Afghani was trying to prove to Renan, who had already decided in advance that not only Islam, but the Semitic mind was incapable of scientific thought, that, well, if you look at it again, perhaps, you know, we had some science sometime in the past. Now, I don't intend any disparagement or derisiveness of that effort. I'm only saying that from the point of view of later resistance to imperialism, in which liberation is the key theme, this variety is a good deal more circumscribed and is consummated by the various nationalist independence movements that occur right across the colonized world. With it belong such different configurations of cultural dependency as the importance of Western advisors, of which one chapter has been chronicled in Jonathan Spence's book, To Change China, whose work helped native peoples or nations, and the phrase used, or the verb used, is to rise. And the presence and efforts of those Western champions of the oppressed, Mrs. Jellyby is an early caricature, who represent the native's interest in a usually hostile or imperial domestic environment. A superb opportunity to see this at work is in the competition between T.E. Lawrence and Louis Massignon immediately after World War I, which was recently described in a wonderful TLS essay by the Oxford historian Albert Hourani. Each man had a genuine empathy with the Arabs. Indeed, Massignon made empathy with Islam the very center of his theory of the monotheistic community and the succession of Abraham, as he called it. And yet each of the two men always acted out of imperial conviction. One served Britain, the other France, for the Arabs. There's tremendous variety in this kind of cooperation between natives on the one hand and oppositional and contradictory representatives of imperialism. An entire massive chapter in cultural history across five continents grows up out of it. The annals of schools and missions, universities, scholarly societies, hospitals in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe, and America fill its pages and have had the effect over time of establishing the so-called modernizing trends in the colonial regions, as well as muting or humanizing the harsher aspects of imperialist domination, all of them bridging the gap between imperial center and peripheral territories. In paying respect to it, acknowledging the shared and combined experiences that produced many of us, we must at the same time note how at its center it nevertheless preserved the 19th century imperial divide between native and Westerner. The great colonial schools, in which I was educated, for example, taught generations of the native bourgeoisie important truths about history, science, and culture. And out of that learning process, millions grasped the fundamentals of modern life, yet remained subordinate dependents of an authority based elsewhere than in their lives. Since one of the purposes of colonial education was to promote the history of France or Britain and demote the native history, there were always the Englands, the Frances, the Germanys, the Hollands, as distant repositories of the word, as Sartre describes it, for all the contradictions developed during the years of productive collaboration. The culmination of this dynamic of dependence is, I said a moment ago, nationalism. Right across the Third World, in the period between the world wars and concluding in the 40s and 50s, new national states appear, all of them declaring their independence from the various European powers whose rule of direct domination had, for various reasons and causes, come to an end. Nationalism in India and Egypt, for instance, was rooted in the long-standing struggle for native rights and independence by nationalist parties like the Indian Congress and the Egyptian WEFT. Similar processes occurred in other parts of Africa and Asia. Nehru, Nasser, Sukarno, and Nkrumah. The pantheon of Bandung flourished in all its sufferings and greatness because of the nationalist dynamic. Crucial works like Panikkar's Asia and Western Dominance, George Antonius's The Arab Awakening, were produced out of it. Nevertheless, there were two political factors whose importance had already been registered in culture and which now marked off the period of nationalist anti-imperialism from the era of liberationist anti-imperialist resistance that followed it. One was a pronounced awareness of culture as imperialism, as a reflexive moment of consciousness that enables the newly independent African, Caribbean, Latin American, or Asian citizen to require a theoretical assertion of the end of Europe's cultural claim to guide and or instruct the non-European. Often this was done, as Thomas Hodgkin has argued, by prophets and priests, versions perhaps of Hobsbawm's pre-capitalist protest and dissent. The second was a dramatic prolongation of the Western imperial mission in various colonial regions, principal among them Algeria, Vietnam, Palestine, Guinea, Cuba. Whether in its general statements such as the Indian Constitution or Pan-Arabism and Pan-Africanism, or in its particular forms such as Senghor's Negritude, nationalism stood revealed as insufficient. Liberation became the strong new theme, a theme already implicit in earlier thinkers in the works of Garvey, Marti, and Du Bois, for instance, but requiring the propulsive infusion of theory and sometimes armed insurrectionary militancy to bring it forward clearly and unmistakably. That we can see and perhaps even judge almost the whole of 19th and early 20th century nationalist history in so stark a way is because of the radically new perspective offered on the culture of imperialism by a deeper oppositional current deriving both from the doctrines of Freud, Marx, and Nietzsche, and from the insufficiencies of nationalist ideology. It is this current in alliance with native resistance that, for instance, allows Aimé Césaire to write his Discourse on Colonialism, in which the ideology of colonial dependency and black racial inferiority are shown to have been incorporated surreptitiously into the modern jargon of psychiatry, which in turn permits Césaire to use the deconstructive theoretical force of psychiatry to undermine its own imperial authority. During the entire period of anti-imperial struggle that grips the Third World after World War I, nationalist culture is dramatically outdistanced by the culture of resistance, a resistance whose core is a very concrete theoretical insurgency directed against the authority as well as the discourse of an imperialism mediated from the national, the historical, and the local levels by its opponents into a new transnational, transcultural, and transpersonal force. Thus, Fanon's theory of violence does not at all answer the appeals of a native chafing under the paternalistic surveillance of a European policeman and, in a sense, preferring the services of a native officer in his place. On the contrary, Fanon's violence first represents colonialism as a totalizing national system fed by imperialism in the same way. Fanon's implicit analogy is devastating, in the same way that human behavior is informed by unconscious desires. Then, in a second quasi-Hegelian step, a Manichaean opposite appears, the insurrectionary native, tired of a logic that reduces him, a geography that segregates him, an ontology that dehumanizes him, an epistemology that essentializes him. Fanon says, the violence of the colonial regime and the counter-violence of the native balance each other and respond to each other in an extraordinary reciprocal homogeneity. The struggle is lifted to a new level of contest, a synthesis, a war of liberation, for which an entirely new post-national theoretical culture is required. If I've spent so much time citing Fanon in these lectures, it is because more dramatically and decisively than anyone, I believe, he symbolizes the immense cultural shift from the terrain of nationalist independence to the theoretical domain of liberation. Moreover, I think Fanon is unintelligible without the theoretical elaboration produced by the culture of late Western, or what Immanuel Wallerstein calls historical capitalism, which is received by the Third World native intellectual as a culture of oppression and colonial enslavement. The whole of Fanon's oeuvre is his attempt, which is unfinished, of course, to grasp those very same theoretical elaboration by an act of political will, thereby to turn them back against their authors in order to be able, in the phrase he borrows from Césaire, to invent new souls. Fanon penetratingly links the settler's conquest of history with imperialism's regime of truth over which the great myths of Western culture preside. The settler, he says, makes history. His life is an epoch, an odyssey. He is the absolute beginning. This land was created by us. He is the unceasing cause. If we leave, all is lost, and the country will go back to the Middle Ages. Over against him, torpid creatures, wasted by fevers, obsessed by ancestral customs, form an almost inorganic background for the innovating dynamism of colonial mercantilism. As Freud had examined the edifice of Western reason by re-excavating its subterranean foundations, as Marx and Nietzsche had reinterpreted the data of bourgeois society by translating them back into primitive but productive impulses towards dominance and accumulation, so Fanon rereads Western humanism by transporting the large hectoring bolus of what he calls the Greco-Latin pedestal, bodily, to the colonial wasteland, where, he says, this artificial sentinel is turned into dust. It cannot survive juxtaposition with its daily debasement by European settlers. There is, I think, a highly conscious sense in the subversive gestures of Fanon's writing of a man deliberately as well as ironically repeating the tactics of the culture he believes has oppressed him. The difference between Freud, Marx, and Nietzsche on the one hand, and Fanon's native intellectual on the other, is that the colonial thinker, the belated colonial thinker, fixes his predecessors geographically. He says they are of the West. The easier to liberate their energies from the oppressing cultural matrix that produced them. By seeing them antithetically as intrinsic to the colonial system and potentially at war with it, Fanon performs an act of closure on the empire and announces a new era. National consciousness, he says, must now be enriched and deepened by a very rapid transformation into a consciousness of social and political needs. In other words, into real humanism. But how oddly the word humanism sounds in this context, where it is free of the individual, the narcissistic individualism, divisiveness, and colonial egoism of imperialism. Like Césaire in his Retour, Fanon's deconstruction of imperialism is in its positive dimension a collective act reanimating and redirecting an inert mass of silent natives into a new and inclusive conception of human history. This huge task, Fanon says, which consists of reintroducing mankind into the world, the whole of mankind, will be carried out with the indispensable help of the European peoples, who themselves must realize that in the past they have often joined the ranks of our common masters where colonial questions are concerned. To achieve this, the European peoples must first decide to wake up and shake themselves, use their brains, and stop playing the stupid fawn of the Sleeping Beauty. It's important to recognize in Fanon's imprecations and his solicitations of European attention, much the same cultural energy that can be noted in writers like Ngugi and Saleh. Its messages are, we must strive to liberate all mankind from imperialism, We must all write our histories and cultures rescriptively. We share the same history, even though for us that history has enslaved us. This, in short, is African writing that is coterminous with the real accomplishments of African liberation. Algeria was liberated, as were Kenya and many other countries. Yet the important connections with the former imperial powers, of course, remain, as do a newly clarified sense of what can and cannot be relied on and salvaged from the former imperial relationship. Once again, it is culture and cultural effort that presage the course of things to come, well in advance of the cultural politics of the post-colonial period, which I shall be discussing tomorrow. Since a great deal of the literature of resistance has been written in the thick of battle, there has been an understandable tendency to concentrate on its combative, often strident assertiveness. In Amilcar Cabral's remarkable speeches and tracts, for instance, no one can miss the extraordinary intensity of the man's mobilizing force, his animosity and violence, the way ressentiment and hate keep turning up in what he has to say. These are all the more evident, of course, against the particularly sordid backdrop of Portuguese colonialism. Yet it would be a serious misreading of such texts as his essay, The Weapon of Theory, or another of his essays and speeches, National Liberation and Culture, to miss. It would be a mistake to, and a misrepresentation, a mistake to read these texts and to miss Cabral's enabling utopianism and his theoretical generosity. To see these is to see then that the emphasis on armed struggle is tactical. For Cabral, the liberation that is gained by violence, organization and militancy is required because imperialism had sequestered the non-European away from experiences that have only been permitted the white man. But, says Cabral, the time has passed when, in an attempt to perpetuate the domination of peoples, culture was regarded as an attribute of privileged peoples or nations, and when out of ignorance or bad faith, culture was confused with technical skill, if not with the color of one's skin or the shape of one's eyes. To end those barriers, Cabral argues, is to admit the non-European to the whole range of human experience. For at last, all humankind can have a destiny, and more important, a history. Certainly, as I said in my first lecture, cultural resistance to imperialism has often, but not always, taken the form of what, for want of a better word, we can call nativism. One finds it not only in Djibouti, but in the great early hero of Algerian resistance, the Emir Abdel Qadir, a 19th century warrior who, while fighting the French armies of occupation for 17 years, from 1830 to 47, also cultivated a cloistral spiritual apprenticeship to the 13th century Sufi master, Ibn Arabi. To fight against the distortions inflicted on your identity is then to return to a pre-imperial period, there to locate a pure or purer native culture untainted by the violence done to natives during centuries of colonialism. This is quite a different thing, however, than revisionist interpretation of history and culture, whose purpose is to demystify the interests at work in the interpretations of subaltern cultures and to appreciate the complexity of the interpretive process. In a way, the nativist argues that one can get past all interpretation to the pure phenomenon, a literal fact beseeching assent and confirmation rather than debate and investigation. Something of this passionate intensity to get back to the pure native phenomenon, if you like, is found in blanket condemnations of the West, such as can be found in Jalal Ali Ahmad's Ghabzadagi, which is translated quite brilliantly by, can't remember the name of the translator, but anyway, he translates it as Occidentosis, a plague from the West. It's a book written in 1961-62. He's an Iranian, one of the early revolutionary Iranian sort of avatars of the Islamic Revolution. But it's also to be found, this nativist impulse is to be found more interestingly and productively in Anwar Abdel Malik's theories of civilizational projects and the theory of endogamous cultures and the various writings of African playwrights and novelists, Shoyinka, for example, on the African sense of myth and identity. Now, I'm not particularly interested in spending much time discussing the particular cultural consequences of decolonizations. Its disabling capacities have been lingered over and caricatured quite long enough by a large army of commentators, beginning obviously with Evelyn Waugh and continuing into Naipaul and John Updike and many of the others. who are expert and amateur alike, but for whom the Western, non-Western world, after the whites have left, has become little more than a nasty mix of tribal chieftains, despotic barbarians, and mindless fundamentalists. Far more interesting commentary on the nativist tendency and the rather naive foundationalist ideology that makes it possible is provided by those Latin American fabulists, historians, essayists, novelists, whose texts demonstrate the manifest impurity of all experience as one reads novelists and magic realists like Borges, Marquez, Fuentes, and so on. One vividly apprehends the dense interwoven strands of a history that mocks linear narrative, easily recuperated essences, and the dogmatic mimesis of pure representation. What I do want to spend time discussing in conclusion about the culture of opposition and resistance is how at its best it suggests a theoretical alternative and a practical method for reconceiving human experience in non-imperialist terms. I use the word tentatively, suggests, rather than the more confident word provides, for reasons that shall become evident as I proceed. Now, the ideological and cultural war against imperialism occurs in the form of resistance in the colonies, in the form of opposition or dissent in the metropolis. The first phase of this dynamic, as I said, I'm recapitulating quickly, the first phase produces national independence movement, and the second, later and more acute phase in the 50s and the 60s, produces liberation struggles. We must keep in mind the basic premise of this analysis that although the imperial divide, in fact, separates metropolis from peripheries, and although each cultural discourse unfolds according to different agendas, rhetorics, and images, they are, in fact, connected, if not always in perfect correspondence. The connection is made on an existential level, since, I've been saying, the imperialist experience is an intertwined and overlapping domain, and the connection is also made in a theoretical or utopian mode of a kind I shall be discussing in a second. Above all else, we need to recognize a consciousness of combined history in the major cultural articulations of the imperialist problematic. There can be little doubt that had they lived, Fanon lived longer, Fanon and Cabral, for example, would have felt considerable disappointment at what their efforts came to. That speculation, I grant, is based on a very special reading of their work as a theory not just of resistance and decolonization, but of liberation. In all sorts of ways, the somewhat inchoate historical forces, the confusing antitheses, the unsynchronized events that their work tried to articulate were not fully controlled or rendered by their work. Fanon was right about the rapacity of what he called the nationalist bourgeoisie. He said that they're in the forefront of independence and fighting against the French in Algeria, but all they would do would simply be to take the place of the French, you know, and they would replace the French bourgeoisie in Algeria with their own form of bourgeois dominance. But he didn't, nor could he, furnish enough of an institutional or even theoretical antidote for the ravages of this nationalist bourgeoisie. But it's not as state builders, or as the awful expression has it, as founding fathers, that the resistance writers should be read and interpreted. Although the struggle for national liberation is continuous with national independence, it is not, and in my opinion never was, culturally continuous with it. To read Fanon and Cabral, or C.L.R. James and George Lamming, or Basil Davidson and Thomas Hodgkin, merely as so many John the Baptists of any number of ruling parties or foreign office experts is a travesty. Something else was going on, and it is a something that sharply disrupts and then abruptly veers away from the unity forged between imperialism and culture during the modern period. For one, the theory and theoretical structures suggested by writers on liberation are rarely given the commanding authority, and I mean the phrase literally, the commanding authority or universalism of their contemporary and largely Western counterparts. There are many reasons for this, not the least being the one I attended to in my previous lecture, that very much like the narrative devices in Heart of Darkness, many cultural theories assume and incorporate the inequality of races, the subordination of inferior cultures, and the acquiescence of those who, in Marx's words, cannot represent themselves and therefore must be represented. Hence, says the Moroccan scholar Abdallah Al-Arawi, the Third World intelligentsia's condemnations of cultural imperialism, Sometimes people, he says, are puzzled by the ill treatment meted out by third world intellectuals to the old liberal paternalism, to Marx's Eurocentrism, and to structuralist anti-racism. And he refers specifically to Lévi-Strauss. This is because they are unwilling to see how these people, Marx, Lévi-Strauss, and the liberal paternalists, they are unwilling to see how these can form part of the same hegemonic system. As an instructive reminder of this unfortunate fact, consider the roughly contemporary work of Michel Foucault and Frantz Fanon, both of whom stress the unavoidable problematic of confinement that stands at the center of Western society. Whereas Fanon's work programmatically seeks to treat colonial and metropolitan societies together as related but, of course, different entities, Foucault's work moves further and further away from any serious consideration of social wholes, focusing instead upon the individual as dissolved in an advancing, ineluctably advancing, microphysics of power, which it is hopeless to resist. Fanon represents the interests of a double constituency, native and Western, attempting to move from confinement towards liberation. Ignoring the imperial context of his own theories, Foucault seems actually to represent an irresistible colonizing movement that paradoxically fortifies the prestige both of the lonely individual scholar and the system that contains him. Both Fanon and Foucault have Hegel, Marx, Freud, Nietzsche, Canguilhem, and Sartre in their heritage. Yet only Fanon presses that formidable arsenal into anti-authoritarian service. Foucault, perhaps because of his disenchantment both with the 60s insurrections and the Iranian Revolution, swerves away from politics entirely. Or there's the whole tenor of Western Marxism in its aesthetic and cultural departments, almost totally oblivious to the entire matter of imperialism. Frankfurt School critical theory, whose seminal insights into the relationships between domination, modern society, and the opportunities for redemption through art as critique, is stunningly silent on, for example, racist theory, anti-imperialist resistance, oppositional practice in the empire. And lest that silence be interpreted as an oversight, we have today's leading Frankfurt theorist, Habermas, reformulating that silence in an interview in the New Left Review as deliberate abstention. No, he says, we have nothing, absolutely nothing to say to anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist struggles in the third world, even if, he adds, I am aware of the fact that this is a Eurocentrically limited view. All the major French theoreticians, with the exception of Deleuze and Derrida, have been similarly unheeding, a fact which has not prevented their ateliers from churning out theories of Marxism, language, psychoanalysis, and history with an implied applicability to the whole world. Much the same thing can be said of most Anglo-Saxon cultural theory, with the important exception of feminism and a small handful of younger critics. So if European theory and Western Marxism as cultural coefficients of liberation haven't in the main proved themselves to be reliable allies in the resistance to imperialism, on the contrary, one can entertain the suspicion that they are part of the same hegemonic universalism that connected culture with imperialism all through the 19th and 20th centuries, how, you could ask, how is the liberationist anti-imperialist thrust broken this shackling unity? First, by a new integrative orientation in history. Second, by an imaginative, even utopian vision whose elements are reconception both of socialist theory and of performance. Third, by an investment neither in new authorities, doctrines, and orthodoxies, nor in established institutions and causes, but in a particular sort of nomadic, migratory, and anti-narrative energy, the fate of which I shall be discussing in my last lecture. I can illustrate my points most economically and end this lecture by looking at a couple of pages in C.L.R. James' study of the great Haitian slave revolution, the study that's called The Black Jacobins. The book appeared in 1938, although 20-odd years later, James appended a further chapter entitled From Toussaint Louverture to Fidel Castro. James is a highly original figure, of course, but it takes nothing away from his contribution to associate his work with that of a group of historians and journalists, some of whom I've referred to, Basil Davidson, Hodgkin, Malcolm Caldwell, among others in Britain, Maxime Rodanson, Jacques Chesneau, Charles Robert Ajoran, among others in France, whose intellectual undertaking was located at the intersection of imperialism with culture, and where writing went the range from journalism to fiction to academic scholarship. That is, quite consciously, there was an attempt not only to write a kind of history saturated in, taking maximum account of, the history and the struggle between imperial Europe and the peripheries, but also to write that history, both in terms of subject matter and treatment or method, from the standpoint and as part of the struggle against imperial domination, employing as many as possible of the weapons in its arsenal. For all of them then, James included, the history of the Third World could only be written by overcoming the assumptions, the attitudes, and the values implicit in colonial narratives. If this meant, as it usually did, adopting a position of advocacy or partisanship, then so be it, since it would be impossible to write of liberation and nationalism, however elusively, without also declaring oneself for or against them. They were correct, I believe, in presuming that in so totalizing a worldview as that of imperialism, there could be no neutrality when either was on the side of the empire or against it, and since they themselves